Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our audience here at the San Francisco office of the Commonwealth Club and our radio and our online audiences. Tonight, we have David Morrison, who is working for NASA Lunar Science Institute as a scientist, but he's also the director of the Carl Sagan Center for Study of Life in the Universe. Now, you might ask, why is he speaking about this topic? But we had a different speaker lined up 2 months ago, and he dropped out. And I asked a good friend of mine, those of you who know them from the SETI project, we had a talk here in September with Jeff Marcy and the director of SETI at Berkeley. And he suggested you, and therefore, because you're an expert in this area too, and I was pleased with somebody with this kind of a background, because I was going to give the humorous lecture myself if nobody else would show up. So I'm really glad that somebody knows about this topic, because it's just a very peculiar part of the human race that we love not only self-destruction, but we love the whole human race to go down every once in a while, and are looking forward to it. It's enough to be mad at your neighbors, you know, but to want the whole thing to go down, it's a popular idea every once in a while. I have always been interested in the humor of this and also the history of it, but in one of the stories that I've written, I had a character who spent decades and decades trying to reform the human race, you know, as baby boomers tended to do, or want to, at least some of them. And at the end of those decades, when he finally had some wisdom, his wisdom was very simple. He said he created a law, and the law is, there is no myth which is so irrational that no one will believe it. And the corollary is, there is no truth which is so obvious that everyone will accept it. So, David Morrison, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure for me to be here. I have been somewhat preoccupied with the end of the world coming in just 2 weeks. I hope I can see the humor in it. I'm not entirely sure that I'm right quite up to thinking it's funny. But we shall see. In any case, I'm going to really talk about two things. Briefly, first, I'm going to talk about my honest-to-goodness day job, which actually is protecting our planet from cosmic impacts. So I guess that puts me in a good position to also talk about the strange rumors that a giant planet is about to crash into the Earth, or all the other things that are being manufactured about December 21st. So my title is Danger from the Sky, Real and Imagined, and I'll begin with the real thing, just to show you I'm a real scientist, and you think about these things. The subject is near-Earth asteroids, or NEAs, and you might wonder why anyone would care about them. They are quite small. There are millions of them. They circulate in the solar system near the orbit of the Earth. In fact, some people have said the Earth is in effect in the middle of a cosmic shooting gallery because these guys hit us. And if you have any doubts about that, look at the moon through a small telescope, and it's covered with craters shoulder to shoulder. The Earth has been hit by the same number of objects over our history. The craters have been erased by geological forces, but our planet has been pummeled just as hard as the moon. So there's been an increasing interest in studying these small, rocky objects for the reasons that, first, there's good science to be done. These are the leftover building blocks of the planets. And we want to look at them. We want to understand their composition. We want to understand their orbits and dynamics, because that tells us about our own background and where we came from. The president, in a speech 2.5 years ago, also proposed that near-Earth asteroids should be the next destination for human flights beyond the Earth-Moon system. That is part of our long-term goal to send humans to Mars, which is a very interesting place. we would use these not quite so interesting objects as, in effect, stepping stones as we expand our capability of sending humans into deep space. As I said, there is a real issue with these objects striking the Earth. If we're surrounded by millions of rocks whose orbits cross the orbit of the Earth, inevitably there are going to be times when we're in the same place as the rock. And this has happened throughout all of history. It didn't matter much most of the time. But here we are, rather more concerned about our own skins. And so there is a very real interest in defending the Earth or defending ourselves against these impacts. And obviously you can't defend against these objects if you don't discover them and learn something about them. Other people have talked about using the near-Earth asteroids as resources. If we ever developed a robust space infrastructure, if we ever had businesses going into space, then clearly one of the things they will want is raw materials. And the most obvious place to get them are these little rocky asteroids. And finally, because of all the above reasons, there is considerable interest in the President, in Congress, and I myself have testified 5 times before the Congress on issues having to do with near-Earth asteroids. This is one of only 2 scientific graphs I will show you. Don't worry about it. It's a very simple representation of the frequency with which the Earth is hit by these small objects. Conveniently, if you plot it on a graph like this, it's a straight line. And it stretches all the way from an impact with the energy of an atom bomb, with the energy of the Hiroshima bomb, which happens about once every year or so, down to the lower right, which represents the impact that killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago by a much larger object, but also much rarer. And so there's a continuum of possible sizes, and the first contribution I made to this field was with colleagues to figure out what this distribution is. The reason is that the first thing anybody asks is, what is the magnitude of the hazard? If you're going to ask the Congress for money, if you're going to ask the scientific community to do research, you have to estimate the hazard. And that's what I mean by the assessment of the hazard. So in the first few years we were working on this, the whole idea was to create a graph like the one I showed you, so you could go to a congressperson, for instance, and say, there is 1 chance in 100 that the Earth will be hit by an asteroid while you are in office, for example. Try to put it in some sort of concrete terms, because you won't get any money or any support for doing the rest of the study until you have established your credibility. It's hard because, if you think about it, nobody you know has ever been killed by an asteroid. Nobody in all of history has ever been killed by an asteroid. You might think, therefore, this was a very quixotic effort. But the fact is that while they don't come often, when they do, they could kill millions or even 1 billion people at one time. The packaging is different from other natural hazards. Instead of frequent small effects, you have humongous ones that come at substantial intervals. And, of course, it's the big ones that you would like to avoid. Well, avoidance in the terminology I often use is called mitigation. And I'm not sure that's a good word. Defense is perhaps better. Having established there is a credible threat or a credible risk, then you have to ask, what could you do to protect the Earth? And absolutely the first thing you must do is discover these objects with telescopes and track their orbits and find out if any is going to hit. That's the stage we've been in for the last 15 years. And we've done a pretty good job, as I will show in a moment. The third step is actually rather interesting. It turns out if you ask a member of Congress, for instance, or many members of the public, are they more worried about the big one that can kill millions of people, but is likely to happen for hundreds of thousands of years, or the little one that might kill very few people is going to happen in your lifetime? In other words, there is a public interest not in finding the biggest ones, but simply in finding the one that's going to happen next. Again, if you're talking with a congressperson, they want to know, what are the chances it will happen during their term? They never think beyond that, or very rarely. And so we have had to adjust our thinking to look also for little ones, even though the actual threat is small, if because it happens more frequently. And what we've done is establish what's called the Space Guard Survey, which is a network of telescopes supported by NASA that is out every night scanning the sky for asteroids. I hope you can sleep better at night to know that astronomers are on the job. And we find these objects, these little near-Earth asteroids, at a remarkable frequency, several a day. And each one that's discovered is immediately has an orbit calculated and is posted on the Internet. There's nothing secret about any of this. It's one of the most transparent activities of the government. You can check yourself. You can go to the website, and the things that were discovered last night will have been put on the website by 4 o'clock this afternoon with orbits, with all the information. Sometimes reporters on a bad news day enjoy going and look there trying to find some evidence of something that sounds exciting. And so that's the process that we have now, and it's been pretty successful. This is a graph that shows the discoveries that have been made, and you can see that whereas 20 years ago the number of these near-Earth asteroids that we knew was only 20 or 30, it's now actually above 9,000, a tremendous increase in our knowledge. And the good news, and I want to end with the good news before we go off into 2012, December 21st, is that we have not found a single asteroid that's going to hit the Earth in our lifetimes. And we have also absolutely excluded that there's any asteroid as large as the one that killed the dinosaurs. Now, the dinosaurs could perhaps have had their own way of predicting what was going to happen to them. They didn't, clearly, and they're gone. They lack two things that we have. They didn't have telescopes, and they didn't have a space program. In the long run, if you actually want to protect the Earth from impacts, rare though they are, you need those two things. You need astronomers to search, and you need to at least think about the technology you would use to deflect an object if it actually were found headed for Earth. Well, you didn't come here to hear about the Space Guard Survey, although it's something I think we can be proud of. It doesn't cost very much money, and it has done a good job of ensuring that we are not about to be hit, as the dinosaurs were, without any warning by some unexpected rock from space. On the other hand, what so many people are obsessed with today is not real objects, but phantom objects. Phantom objects associated with the 21st of December. And I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about the origin of this strange thing that is happening now. I say strange thing that's happening. What really bothers me is that there have been at least one poll that suggested that approximately 1 in 10 Americans is worried about or does not expect to live past December 21st. Now, are any of you in that situation? Is any of you worried that you won't live? Well, you're not a typical group. I could have guessed that when we came here. But if we were, there would be several hands go up, and people are urging folks who are afraid to buy guns and ammunition, to stock up on food and water, in some cases to build shelters in the backyard or under their houses. And I worry a little bit about what some of those people are going to do when December 21st comes, or even when December 22nd comes, and they're still here. So what are the things that people are worried about? I guess I should start with the Mayan apocalypse. The idea that the ancient Mayas built a calendar which ends on December 21st, and in some versions that they actually predicted some sort of cataclysm for that time. I am not a Maya scholar, I'm an astronomer, but I have taken the trouble to talk to some who do understand the Maya religion and the Maya writings. And they tell me first that it is absolutely untrue that their calendar ends. The Mayan calendar is made up of long cycles of day counts. The biggest one is about 5,000 years long. And that cycle does end sometime around now. Maybe it was last year, maybe it's next year, but it's a fair guess that it might end at the winter solstice this year. And so you might think that was the end of the calendar because this big count comes to an end. But the archaeologists who dig up the Mayan ruins and look at the writings say that they have found several more dates in the future. That is, the Mayans, even though they were destroyed practically by their culture, by the Europeans 600 years ago, they were making predictions and referring to dates in the future. So clearly they did not expect their calendar to end, but merely to recycle. The simple analogy is what your own calendar will do at the end of December. I don't think very many of you, when you tear off that last page in the calendar, believe that that's the end of the world. You know that the calendar starts again on January 1st. And it's similar with the Mayan long count. Whenever it ends, it may or may not be December 21st, whenever it ends, it starts again. The Mayan calendar is a remarkable construction of mathematics, of counting. It is a very poor representation of the things we think about. They did not know, for instance, how many days were in a year with any accuracy. They didn't keep track of years or months or weeks. It served a different purpose, a primarily religious purpose, I think. And for that purpose, it was very good. But I am absolutely amazed when I read people telling me that the Mayan calendar was better than ours, was more accurate than ours, that NASA uses the Maya calendar in planning its space exploration. Not true. So what are the things that people are most concerned about? They come from quite different places, and there's been a convergence on this December 21st date. I presume the date was picked based on the Mayan situation. And then every other crackpot idea got pulled together with it. One, for instance, is that there are forces between the planets that will align on December 21st, causing a sudden pole shift, massive earthquakes and floods, actually reversing the rotation of the Earth. Something that clearly has never happened before. And so you might ask, what is this alignment? Are the planets all in a line? No. You can look. In fact, they are remarkably widely distributed through the sky. It's about as far from an alignment as you could get. But there's something else that does happen. In late December, as the sun goes through the sky, the Earth orbiting the sun, but the sun appearing to move around the sky, you reach a time when the Earth and the Sun and the center of our galaxy are approximately lined up. Not precisely, you know, just sort of at an angle to each other. And they say that this is the danger, that there's actually a giant black hole at the core of our galaxy. It's 30,000 light years away. But they believe that some strange force gets focused by the fact that the sun is approximately in the same direction, and all those beams from that black hole somehow come and destroy the Earth. I remind you, by the way, that a black hole doesn't emit beams of anything. It's black. It absorbs everything. But this is the sort of thing you hear about on the Internet. Another issue is, I didn't conclude that. This alignment, this approximate alignment of the Earth, the Sun, and the black hole takes place every December. So I say to people, did you survive December 21st of last year? And, you know, they claim all the volcanoes were erupt, earthquakes. I said, did all the volcanoes erupt last December? Were there huge earthquakes last December? Then don't worry about this December. It happens every year. Well, another issue is a planet, a rogue planet, coming into the inner solar system that is supposed to crash into the Earth and literally destroy the planet. We're now talking about not the end of civilization, but the end of Earth, the end of the world. I don't quite understand how buying guns and supplies and drinking water is supposed to protect you when the Earth is destroyed, as it certainly would be if another planet as bigger or larger than the Earth crashed into us. Now, you might think about if there were such an object, such a giant planet headed for Earth, when would you be able to see it? How bright would it be right now, 2 weeks before impact? Well, it would be brighter. It would be about as bright as the moon. You could see it in the daytime or at night. It would have been easily visible to the naked eye for the last year. It would have been visible to astronomers for at least 10 years. They would have been tracking it. Remarkably, no astronomer has ever reported this thing coming. And the conspiracy theory, which much of this is, says that the government is hiding this information. That, although they don't put it this way, that all 100,000 astronomers in 100 different countries who have telescopes and who could be seeing it are in the pay of NASA. And NASA is able to stop them from telling about it. Ah, but you'd say, what about the other 7 billion people on Earth that should be seeing it? Well, there's an answer for that, too. They say that the government is filled the sky with airplanes that are spraying contrails so that the sky will become covered with clouds and we can't see it coming. I ask these people, have you looked at the sky lately? Can you still see the sun in the daytime? Can you still see the moon or Jupiter or Venus at night? Clearly that isn't working very well, is it? Well, NASA is the focus of a lot of these, and that's how I got into answering questions from the public. I have been answering questions about science, real honest-to-goodness science questions, mostly about astronomy and astrobiology that are sent to NASA's Ask an Astrobiologist website for 10 years. And that was a lot of fun. I'd get usually two or three questions a day and pick one, post an answer. Until 4 years ago, when the first question came, what about Nibiru, the planet that's going to come hit the Earth? I made perhaps the mistake that I answered. Next week, I got three more. Week after that, I was getting 10, 20. Before I knew it, within a few months, I was getting far more questions about the end of the world than the science. I don't think very many other scientists were bothering to answer these questions. Indeed, hardly anyone knew about it. I would go to my colleagues and say, hey, I've got this interesting question. These people, things are coming about the end of the world. And they would look at me like I'd just grown two heads. What do you mean? That's crazy. Nobody could believe that. But people do. And by now, it's just gotten more and more. This weekend, I got 150 such emails by people who I think mostly are genuinely afraid that the world is going to end in 2 weeks. Well, part of the problem is that the government is obviously covering up, blinding everyone so they can't see. All the astronomers are in the government's pay. And, of course, the astronomers will do whatever the government says. I'm an astronomer. I know you couldn't get any six astronomers to follow any thing that the government told them. Now, to say nothing of all the other governments. And then you might ask, if the NASA is the big cover-up, why are they writing to NASA? I am amazed at the number of questions that start, I know you work for the government, so you won't tell me the truth. But, and then they ask the question. Anyway, NASA is not covering up the information. And NASA has actually, in the last few months, stepped up for this, not just me, but they've created websites and have felt that we have some obligation here. Even if we think this stuff's crazy, if there are millions of people who are worried about the end of the world, and many of the things they're worried about are related to space one way or another, astronomers. You know, NASA does have some of the world's experts in geology and astronomy and planetary science. Maybe we should answer. It's not been an easy decision to make. As long as it was just me doing it, it didn't matter. Finally, the question came, should NASA hold a press conference and discuss this? This question went all the way up to the highest levels in the agency. The obvious problem would be that even if 10% of the people are terribly afraid, there's another 90% that isn't. And so if NASA holds a press conference, this gives credibility to the whole thing. So it's been a complex issue in public relations, if you will, but really in fundamental education. How far should you go to deal with a small fraction of the people who are really confused and really afraid of this? Some of the conspiracy theories go a long way. One of the popular ones is that really there is no Nibiru. There is nothing going to happen on December 21st. But the government has created this idea, not the people but the government, as a cover-up for the global takeover by the New World Order or the Illuminati. And so while everyone is preoccupied with worrying about Nibiru or some other cosmic disaster, we're going to see the helicopter, big black helicopters, and the blue-hatted UN people and so forth come and take over the government. Well, let me go back to some other aspects of this weird story. How many of you saw the movie 2012? Did you like it? Right. It turns out it had almost nothing to do with 2012. And I wondered about that because these stories about Nibiru and pole shifts and things never appear in it until I had the occasion a year or so to be on the platform with one of the people who played a scientist, one of the actors who played a scientist in the film, explained to me that the film had been written, was already in production with a different title. That then someday, in effect, somebody walked in and said, hey, I just went on the internet, and there are a lot of people out there scared about 2012. They said, oh, good, let's just take that title and use it. It clearly raised people's awareness of a 2012 disaster scenario. But it actually helped me, because one of the best reposts that you can do when someone sends you a note about these awful things like California falling into the ocean, and you say, oh, that's just Hollywood. You don't believe Hollywood, do you? You don't take your science from Hollywood films. That usually shuts people up. When I first encountered this almost 4 years ago, I went to the internet and looked at the book list for 2012 Doomsday on Amazon.com and was flabbergasted to find more than 300 books published on that. There's at least twice that many now. This is just a few. There are a lot of people out there trying to make money by peddling this myth, or even more, by selling books with titles like How to Survive 2012. Do-it-yourself kits. Let me now talk about the actual specific sources, because they are amusing when you look at them in toto. The first, where it really started, was a woman named Nancy Leader, who says she's a psychic. Better than that, she actually has an implant in her brain of a chip that receives messages from aliens in a planet around the star Zeta Reticuli. And since about 1980, they have been sending her warnings to the people of Earth about this terrible tragedy that was coming. In fact, she, for a long time, on her website, said it was going to happen on May 23rd of 2003. Up to 1 week before the supposed impact, she was still saying that. And then, oops, sorry, this was just a practice run. It's really going to happen on December 21st of 2012. And that's what she says on her website now. Zechariah Sitkin, a very interesting man, an economist who became very interested in the civilizations of Mesopotamia, in particular Sumer, and according to what he will tell you, taught himself how to read the Sumerian language. The people who really know Sumerian say he's got it wrong. He just makes up his translations. But he managed to publish half a dozen books talking about the Sumerians and Nibiru. This planet actually came by Earth, and the inhabitants on it came to Earth and gave ancient Sumer the rudiments of civilization. Urban life, irrigation, writing. Indeed, Sumer was one of the world's first great civilizations. But instead of smart people thinking of it, this was a gift from these gods, in effect, who were on board. And they have said that it's coming back now. Only this time, apparently, instead of benign gifts from the people who live on Nibiru, they think it's going to crash into the earth and destroy us. There's a little inconsistency there. They were so nice to us 7,000 years ago, and this time... See, the problem is, of course, if it destroys the earth, it'll destroy Nibiru, too, which seems like a very long way to go to punish us for our misuse of the technology they first brought to us. There are a lot of stories about the Mayans. The whole idea of the Mayan calendar ending was a construct in the 20th century of people trying to perhaps overinterpret some of the things in the Mayan writing. One person who does that is named John Mayer Jenkins. If you look on his website, he calls himself an independent researcher. Do you know what that means? No degree, no job. He is down there in Middle America, and he writes all these stories about how the Mayans predicted exactly what was going to happen this December 21st, that the Earth was going to be in the dark rift of the Milky Way, which is a great dark cloud in the Milky Way that's thousands and thousands of light years away, and that this was going to be part of some terrible destruction myth. Now, I'm sorry to even mention the next one, Michio Kaku, because I know he has spoken here at the Cosmos Club. Not the Cosmos Club, at the Commonwealth Club. Probably at the Cosmos Club also. And he's a brilliant speaker, a popularizer. But he has done a lot of harm in this case by his extreme simplification and over-dramatization. He talks about the sun, not as our friend, but as our enemy, and has claimed for years that this particular solar maximum, the sun goes up and down an 11-year period, is going to be much more violent than usual, and that there's going to be, in effect, a gigantic explosion from the sun. It's going to flip its magnetic field, send a shockwave out through the solar system. Well, I believe Michio Kaku knows a lot about cosmology and string theory, but he's got a little wrong on what the sun does. Another thing that's hard to be specific about, do any of you watch the cable channels Discovery, History, and Science? They're all run by the same organization, and they have all moved more and more into pseudoscience, presumably because it sells. Even National Geographic has gotten in that. And whatever you may say about the individual things, the stories on ancient aliens and Nostradamus and doomsday preppers and so on, there's a cumulative effect of hyper-pushing of fear and destruction. And these are supposedly educational channels that some of us encourage our children to watch. Be careful. One of my colleagues who's very much involved in the Universe series on the History Channel, I asked him, I said, why is there constantly explosions and planets crashing and stars exploding and so forth? He said, that's very intentional. It's required by the producers and people who make it. They have found out that the average person surfing through the channels will spend only 90 seconds on each channel before moving on, unless you can grab them. with something, explosion or something violent. So no more nice talking heads like Carl Sagan back in the Cosmos days. It's got to all be pumped up. Whether that relates directly to the fear of this 2012, I don't know, but it seems to me it sets part of the background. NASA, of course, is blamed. You probably don't know what NASA stands for in the lexicon of the conspiracy theory. Never a straight answer. Now, some people who understand that this is a conspiracy thing that's out there that's not real have specifically said, but there are so many people afraid of it. Why doesn't President Obama set up a nationwide speech and tell us that we will not all die on December 21st? What do you think of that idea? Do you think people who are afraid of this would believe him? Do you think that would add credibility? It's a strange notion because some people blame the government for being a cover-up and for not telling the truth, and then others turn around and blame the government because we are not out there. I have not personally asked President Obama to speak on this topic. I have the feeling he's involved with other things. Let me conclude now by just showing you quite specifically some of the questions that I receive. As I have said, this weekend alone, I received more than 150 questions. They've just added up, and these are just a tiny sampling. Why is it that you say Nibiru does not exist, yet I found videos on YouTube that say NASA has confirmed that it does exist? But I suppose you would be fired or worse if you admitted this. I understand that Congress has passed a law making it illegal to release information about an incoming object. In a YouTube video, they announced that NASA has known about Nibiru since 1982. I suspect you have explored something that we civilians aren't supposed to know. And then very specific cases. There's one who said a cousin's friend's 16-year-old sister threw herself in front of a train from depression. There is a well-documented case in England of a 16-year-old girl who hanged herself because of worry. There are others, I don't know if they're true, but clearly this is a recurrent theme of young people especially, that they would commit suicide rather than suffer in the end of the world. I personally would have thought that even if you believed the end was coming, you might want to stay around just to see it. Adults get very worried. This woman said, I'm a young woman from Denmark. Yesterday I was considering killing myself, the new baby, and my beloved two-year-old daughter before December 12 for fear of having to experience the Earth's destruction. Please tell me the truth. Another, I have two young children and just live to protect them. I can't cope with not knowing what's going to happen. I will truly go mad. If the government knew about Nibiru, wouldn't they keep it a secret to avoid panic? After all, NASA means never a straight answer. And this one I thought was especially touching. I'm so scared. My only friend is my little dog. When should I put her to sleep so she won't suffer when the Earth is destroyed? A lot of the messages I get are apparently from children. I should explain that, contrary to what some people think, NASA does not keep track of the people who write. I'm sure that there are lots of companies and banks and so forth that know everything about you. But when you write to NASA, they do not ask for any identifying information. So I can never verify who these came from. I just have to take it as what I get. I'm in the eighth grade, and I'm considering suicide right now. I'm scared to tears. I don't want to go to school anymore. I don't want to spend time with my family anymore. I don't want to live anymore. I believe that I deserve an explanation. A man on TV said that if government officials spoke up, they would be killed. Perhaps the one thing that I am fairly sure of was a meeting I went to of educators in this summer. And a science teacher from Stockton came up to me and said that in the previous few weeks, the parents of two of her middle school kids had come to her and said they planned a mass suicide to kill their children and themselves before December 21st. And in this case, she did bring in authorities and I hope dealt with it. But that case, I'm quite confident, is real. Much of this is based on an amazing reverence for the wisdom of ancient civilizations. People say, I've heard that the Maya have been accurate in the past with other planetary stuff, and their calendar is more accurate than ours. So if they have predicted an end in 2012, how can you be sure you know more than they did? How do I answer that? I don't believe in prophecy. I don't care how smart they were. I don't see how they could have predicted what was going to happen hundreds of years after the end of their civilization. Got the same thing from the Sumerians, that the planet's oldest recorded civilization, from which we derived all of our mathematical, astronomical, language, time, science, and so forth. Perhaps you didn't know that. They also had discovered the other planets. They knew the shape, color, size, and orbit of Uranus and Neptune and even Pluto without benefit of telescopes. So, of course, we should believe them. And people who have looked for the linkages have ended up saying that they can find predictions from the Egyptians, the Aztecs, the Sumerians, the Bible, the Hopi, all saying that the world will end this month. I have asked people where the Bible verse is that does that, and I've never gotten an answer. Let me just summarize by explaining, in case anyone asks you, how we know that there is not a planet Nibiru going to destroy the Earth. What you hear on the Internet, and I should say again that this is entirely an Internet phenomenon. There are tens of thousands of websites. There are many thousands of YouTube videos, all saying that the world will end. Very few saying the other. And I can't quite visualize who these people are that believe that, but it's quite clear that they do not listen to regular television news. They do not read newspapers. They do not read magazines. From the beginning, I have said to them, look, if this was true, don't you think it would be in the newspapers? That doesn't even occur to them. One person wrote to me and said, what I visualize the typical person who's writing to you is a preteen sitting in the basement of his mother's house with a computer, never going outside, never looking out of the window, never reading anything else, just spending all day with YouTube videos. And that's how they get their information. Anyway, as I have said, if there were an object coming, whether you call it Nibiru or Planet X or anything else, whether you say it's bigger than the Earth or smaller than the Earth, it would be the third brightest object in the sky after the sun and moon. In fact, it's getting up to lunar size. You would also see it as, you know, a physical disk, not just a point. And it's, no one has seen it. The way these stories appear on the Internet are fascinating to me. There will be a YouTube video that says, Nibiru spotted over Brooklyn. There was a big thing a year ago that there were two suns seen in China. Two suns? Do you think if there were two suns in the sky, you would notice it? Wouldn't have to be the Chinese. Actually, it turned out to be a small island off the coast of Taiwan that would need to tell you this was happening. People don't use their heads and their eyes. Incidentally, even if it were somehow mysteriously black and reflected no light so we couldn't see it, it would still have gravity. And the effect of its gravity would be to distort the orbits of all the planets it passed near. We actually measure that very precisely. We have, as you know, a wonderful Curiosity rover on the surface of Mars. We have 4 or 5 satellites in orbit. We communicate with them every day. As part of that communication, we daily measure the distance between the Earth and Mars to within a few centimeters. If there were the tiniest change, we would know it. Some people say it's going to change the tilt of the Earth's axis. You know what would happen if the Earth's axis tilt changes a little bit? The first thing, GPS would fail, and planes would be crashing. You would all immediately know if there were a change in the tilt of the Earth's axis. It's not happening. To me, this is simply an example of what I call cosmophobia, fear of the universe. I'm not going to go through the thing in detail, but I have had so many messages from young people expressing fear. When I was a kid, I read Sky and Telescope magazine, I had my telescope. When I would read about a new comet discovered or a new star or something happened, I thought, hey, that's cool. There are people now whose first reaction is, will it hurt me? They're afraid of the sun. They're afraid of shifts in the Earth's magnetic field or the disappearance of the magnetic field. They're afraid of the solar coronal mass ejections. They're afraid of the alignment of Jupiter and Saturn. By the way, a lot of people have worried about the alignment of two planets. I think two points determine a line. They're always in alignment with each other. They think they're all sorts of, they think the Earth, the solar system is about to pass through the plane of the galaxy. They don't know what the galaxy is. They don't know what the plane is, but they're afraid of it. You may have seen an announcement a few months ago that astronomers had determined that the Andromeda galaxy, the big spiral that's similar to us, and our Milky Way galaxy were headed toward each other, and we would actually crash in between 2 and 3 billion years. The next day, I got messages saying, when the Andromeda galaxy crashes into us, will I be killed? So it's a strange world we live in. I don't know what is happening. There are so many smart people. There's so much wonderful stuff on the Internet. But there are things that truly lead people astray. A friend of mine described the Internet as the world's greatest library without benefit of librarians. I think if nothing else, it would be wonderful if we could teach people how to distinguish truth from fiction on the Internet. And I'm happy to say some of my colleagues who teach, both in college and lower level, have done this with their students. They pick 2 YouTube videos, for instance, one like a crazy and one from good scientists, ask them to go watch them and then come discuss how they could tell the difference, which one was believable and which one wasn't. It's a whole new talent that none of us had to worry about. This overload of information and the difficulty of distinguishing truth from fiction. But the truth is, we will all live to see Christmas this year.
And you're promising that's not a government cover-up, right?
I'm from NASA. How could you doubt it?
All right. I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to David Morrison speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And now it's time for Q&A. We have time for about 5 or 6 questions, so we'll start.
You concentrated on supposedly physical effects that would lead to the destruction of the world. There are also people who believe in supernatural effects, a second coming or something like that. How do these two things mesh together?
I don't know how they mesh together. I try to avoid the supernatural, particularly when people write me questions that are framed, as many do, in Christian or Islamic terms. I've had a number of things written to me by Muslims who have said, this is all crazy talking about the end of the world because it says in the Quran that no man may know when the world is going to end. I don't go there. I'm sure it's a real component, but I try to stick to things I know, which is astronomy and the question of whether or not there really is something physically out there threatening us.
Yeah. Is there an explanation why meteors have a significant component of iridium, which is a very rare element on Earth, and of course led to the Alvarezes across the bay there discovering or that 65 million years ago. And secondly, we read about this big crater in Arizona and the Siberian thing. Could you talk a little about that and the size of the meteors and what type of destruction it would have?
Yeah, the iridium, of course, was the key discovery from the Alvarez work. that identified an extraterrestrial impact as the cause of the Cretaceous extinction that killed the dinosaurs. The reason is the Earth has plenty of iridium, but it's in the core. It's a so-called iron-loving element. When the Earth differentiated, meaning the heavy stuff went to the center, the iridium went to the center, along with platinum and other things. That's why platinum is so valuable, not because it is intrinsically rare in the universe, but because it's rare on the surface of the Earth. So when we are impacted by an object from outside that has the average composition, it shows up to us as an excess of iridium and other elements that are mostly not present on the surface of the Earth. The second thing, say again what it was.
Well, I just wanted to talk about the Siberian
meteor. Right. The Siberian impact, so-called Tunguska impact, and the impact that produced Meteor Crater in Arizona were both about the same size energy object. It was something about 40 meters across, the size of a typical 3 or 4 story building. And in one case, it landed in the desert of Arizona and dug a big crater. In the other case, it was made of more friable, loose material and exploded in the atmosphere with about the same energy. Those things happen about once every few hundred years on Earth. But of course, they only affect the local area. There's nothing global about them.
Next question.
Your talk reminds me, Einstein once said, information is not knowledge. But my question is, in a previous slide, you indicated the term brown dwarf. What does that mean in the context of your presentation?
A brown dwarf is an object that's between a star and a planet in mass. The thing that determines whether a forming object lights up with internal fusion reactions and becomes a star is its mass. If its mass is a little below that level, instead of lighting up with a self-sustaining reaction that makes it a star, it gradually gets warm and then cools down, and that's what we call a brown dwarf. It's much more massive than a planet, but not necessarily much brighter.
What was the name of that? Nibiru. Is that Sumerian? And also, what is Tunguska? And even if we could track and see, you know, some terrible big object coming towards us that would destroy us, what on earth could we do about it, though, you know?
Well, Nibiru is a Sumerian name. It's quite an obscure Sumerian name. It is apparently a minor god, or perhaps a manifestation of Jupiter, of Marduk, the chief god. There's no reason to ever think it was a planet or anything like that, and the word only appears a few times in all Sumerian writing. Tunguska is simply the location where this impact took place, in Siberia, on the Stony Tunguska River, which is way out in the wilderness, which is why we had this big impact 100 years ago, a huge explosion, and it didn't kill anybody. It did kill reindeer, but it really was out in the wilderness.
And how could we defend ourselves?
Oh, how could we defend ourselves? Well, that is, of course, the topic of a whole other lecture. As an astronomer, I say very emphatically, you hardly can even think about defense until you find them. If you found an object, an incoming object, with a warning of several decades, I am confident that we have the space technology and we would then have the motivation to figure out how to deflect it, just change its orbit a little bit so it missed. If you found a big object headed for the Earth with a warning of a couple of years, which is the way it's always shown in Hollywood movies, I'm afraid you should just drink up your wine in your wine cellar and hope it doesn't hit where you are.
On this slide right here, I think I'm a little confused by the first box, the Hiroshima-sized event, which the chart implies it happens on about an annual basis. But if that was the case, wouldn't we hear about that happening? That's a pretty big event.
That's a wonderful question, because my colleague Clark Chapman and I first put this together. And our immediate response when we saw that is, we have really screwed up. We've made some orders of magnitude error, because it didn't make sense that there could be a Hiroshima-sized explosion on Earth every year and we'd never read about it in the papers or heard about it, until we figured out that that size object indeed is energetic. It has the energy of an atom bomb, but it explodes so high in the atmosphere that nothing gets to the surface. Shortly after that, we got access at the end of the Cold War to the surveillance satellites that the military operates, looking down. And they see those flashes in the atmosphere, and they verify that we get an impact about that size approximately annually. We don't see it from the ground looking up. They see it from the satellites looking down.
And should there be a press conference about that? One last question. Great.
I was wondering if there are any YouTube videos that said that the end of the Earth, that this 2012 apocalypse was just the result of some diabolical plot to distract and scare everybody, and it wasn't true.
Absolutely. You can get YouTube videos that say anything. But those are the ones who say that it's really a cover-up for the takeover by the UN and the Illuminati that are going to destroy our government with the help of our president, and that's all going to happen in 2 weeks also.
A quick question. Do you believe in the ancient astronaut theory?
Do I believe that astronauts visited the Earth in historic time? No. I don't see any evidence of it. And I personally am a little bothered by people that think our ancestors in Egypt or Sumer or whatever were not smart enough to figure things out and build them. I think we're plenty smart enough to do that. We don't need help from benign aliens who landed then and have conveniently disappeared since then.
Or just never wanted to come back after they dealt with us. All right. Thank you very much, David. That was a great talk. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.